Today's Teisho will be on Case 21, Umon's Kan Shiketsu. A monk asked Umon, "What is Buddha?" Umon replied, "Kan Shiketsu." Umon's comment: Umon was too poor to prepare plain food, too busy to speak from notes. He hurriedly took up shiketsu to support the way. The decline of Buddhism was thus foreshadowed. Mumon's verse: lightning flashing, sparks shooting, a moment's blinking, missed forever. Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen this morning. This is a very famous koan. Master Umon, his name means Cloud Gate, is author of a number of really important koans in the koan collections that Zen students practice with. This one is famous because of its title and its subject matter. I should explain that, you know, if you hear the koan read aloud, "What is Buddha?" And Umon replied, "Kan Shiketsu." You think, "What is Buddha?" You know, Buddha must be something very special. I mean, you know, originally in Buddhism, Buddha, the word Buddha, referred to a person. So the word Buddha originally referred to a person whose name was Siddhartha Gautama. Siddhartha Gautama grew up in northeastern India, in the region that is now between India and Nepal. He belonged to a clan or a tribe called the Shakya. And the Shakya had a legendary, like so many people in the world, the Shakya had a legendary ancestor whose name in English is sugarcane. So the Shakya, you know, in Judaism, Jewish people trace their ancestry back to a person named Abram, who was renamed Abraham, and that means father of a multitude, father of a multitude. So it's like a mythical ancestor. I've just been reading the Popol Vuh, the great classic of the Mayan culture, and they have four ancestors. They all have special names: Dark Jaguar, Jaguar Forest, and so on. Very cool. The ancestor of the Shaka people was called Sugarcane. And they lived in northeastern India. And they were, by all accounts, pretty peace-loving people. They actually had a kind of democracy. They had an assembly, like a Greek democracy. They actually did. And 500 people would attend, and there was actually like a speaker of the house. And they followed majority rule, and their little country is remembered as the Shakya Republic. Around the time of the Buddha, the Shakya Republic was invaded by a military power called Kosala, and wiped off the earth. So in the Buddha's own lifetime, his people experienced the genocide. There are no Shakya people left in Asia. Buddha, historical Buddha, was named Siddhartha Gautama. And in our tradition, in Mahayana Buddhism, we call him Shakyamuni. And Shakya is a reference to these historical people, the Shakya, who created the Shakya Republic and who suffered genocide in the Kosalan invasion. And Muni means a sage. So northern Buddhists, we Mahayana people, call Siddhartha Gautama Shakyamuni. And everybody knows the story of Siddhartha Gautama. He was born, supposedly, according to the legend, as a prince. But in fact, the Shakya people didn't have any monarchs. They didn't have any princes or dukes. They were a democratic republic, really. And so it's probably the case that the Buddha's father was like a tribal chieftain. The Shakyas did have sort of like tribal chieftains, like the Scots, you know. So every family had a head of the family, and probably the heads of the families showed up at the assembly where they voted things up and down. So it's probably the case that Siddhartha Gautama's father wasn't really a prince, but was like a tribal chieftain. At the time of Siddhartha's birth, his mother died, and his father is supposed to have received a prophecy that the baby would either be a great world conqueror, like, you know, victorious military leader, or a great sage. So his father was kind of like a tribal chieftain and did not want him to be a monk, and so educated him in all the arts, the martial arts. So, if you read the early Buddhist sutras, Buddha makes many references to military arts that he probably learned in growing up. So he was very good as an archer. He was an excellent horseman. We know actually quite a bit about the historical Buddha. And he will talk about how you aim an arrow with a bow or how you ride a horse in his discourses. The Buddha's father was very worried that the Buddha would not grow up to be a great military leader, but would instead become a forest-dwelling sage, and he tried to protect the Buddha from existential realities, kept him in a family compound that was very beautiful, and everything he wanted he had. So he had a privileged life. But according to the legend, you know, he left his family compound and he saw a person who was terribly afflicted. And he went out of the compound, maybe with a servant, and he saw somebody who was, covered with sores. And he says to his servant, what's wrong with that person? And the servant says, well, you know, actually, he's sick. He has this, he has like smallpox or something, you know. And then the Buddha, in his foray out of the compound, saw somebody who just looked terrible. You know, his or her skin was sagging, hair had turned white, looked really used up. What's with that person? You know, and maybe the servant said, well, that's old age. You know, we've protected you from that. And then finally found a corpse. What's wrong with this person? He's dead. So according to the legend, you know, the mythology, the Buddha left his family compound and saw these things, and it was like an earth-shattering experience. Now, it seems unlikely to me that the Buddha actually didn't know about these things. Probably what happened was that he had lived a very privileged life, you know, and he had just gotten married to a beautiful, intelligent woman, and he just had a little son. And for some reason, at that moment in his life, the idea that that we're very vulnerable and very exposed, it just hit him like a ton of bricks. The precariousness of our existence just became overwhelmingly troubling to him. Maybe because he was so happy. He had a beautiful wife. Sometimes when people have children, they suddenly realize that the clock is ticking on their own lives. You know, it's suddenly like you have this child, you bring new life, and you suddenly realize, wait a minute, you know, I'm a little bit superfluous. You know, I'm on the way out. You know, here's the new life. Where's the old life? Oh, I'm the old life. So it's possible something like that happened. But he had a crisis, you know, and this idea that we're all going to die, you know, what is it about, you know, just became overwhelming for him. And it bothered him so much that he did something that in Asian culture is absolutely never done. You know, he abandoned his family. It's not supposed to be done in our culture either, but, Asian cultures tend to be very family-centric, much more than like modern Western people. And he just walked out. He left his wife, he left his infant son, and he went to live with these sages, these forest-dwelling yogins, people practicing meditation in the forest. And, this was part of a movement in India at this time. You know, there were these hereditary priests called Brahmins who mostly did rituals and preserved ancient teachings of the Vedas, ancient Indian scriptures. But there was like this revolution going on in India because India was becoming, you could say, more democratic. You know, and lots of people said, well, what do these Brahmins really know? You know, what do they know? It says in the sutras, it says rather in the scriptures, this is the case, you know. But how do we know? Why should we listen to these guys? They don't know anything. So there was this like revolution going on, and these people would go out in the forest where they could be sequestered, and they would practice meditation, searching for, to cut through illusion and achieve like insight into the nature of reality. And meditating many, many hours a day. So the Buddha decided to take this path and not become a military leader or tribal chieftain. And then he met a teacher whose name was Alara Kalama, who was one of the most distinguished meditation masters in his day. And Alara Kalama taught the Buddha how to enter deep samadhi. Deep samadhi. So we do that even now, right? We watch the breath until we enter deep samadhi. And the Buddha entered deep samadhi, but he realized, you know, even in deep samadhi, I feel uneasy. Deep samadhi has not solved my problem. You know, that insight I had that, you know, life is very here today and gone tomorrow. I'm going to die. You know, this sense of uneasiness I feel, exposure or vulnerability, getting into samadhi helps for a little while, but when I come out of samadhi, I'm right back in that place again. And we all can experience that, you know. You can get into a very beautiful state on the cushion, but when you're off the cushion, you're back in a state of anxiety. You know, the Buddha was such a great student of Alara Kalama that Alara Kalama said, you know, I'd love for you to stay and be my my heir. And the Buddha said, no, I can't do that. You know, I'm not satisfied with your insight. So then he went to study with the other really like preeminent meditation master of the day, whose name was Udraka Ramaputra. And Udraka Ramaputra had discovered, these people were meditating many hours a day and exploring the mind in deep samadhi. And he had discovered what we call shunyata, or mu, emptiness. And he taught the Buddha how to enter deep samadhi and then how to enter emptiness. And the Buddha entered deep mushin, deep emptiness, deep shunyata, and became very accomplished at this. And then, Udraka Ramaputra said, you're really good at this. I'd like you to stay here and be my heir. And the Buddha said, no, this is still not enlightenment. This is still not satisfying to me. So the Buddha went off into the forest on his own. And he joined five people who are five other meditators. And they all had this same sort of dread, about life. Why are we here? Who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? I don't know if you've ever seen those wonderful paintings by Gauguin, but it's like those are the big questions. Who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? And so these five people and the Buddha had to answer that question. And they had read all the holy books, and they thought, I just can't buy this. It just doesn't help. And they had studied, with the Brahmins, and they all said, these guys don't know anything. They don't really know anything. So they went off in there on their own, and they meditated and ate very little and so on. And the Buddha really pushed himself like to the edge of death, basically. He was eating, according to the legend, he was eating like a grain of rice a day. Right? So you would die if you did that, but little amount of food. And his companions were in the same sort of very austere, practicing these incredible austerities. And then the Buddha just realized, this is not working out. I still don't have any insight. I'm just starving to death. So he left his five companions, and he went into the local village, and there was this farm girl there. And the farm girl said, "Oh my God, you look terrible. You look like you haven't eaten in a year." So she said, "Why don't I give you here's some rice and a bowl of milk. Why don't you have this rice? You're obviously a sadhu. You're obviously this holy man, a rishi-type person living in the forest. But you look like you're going to die if you don't get something to eat here." And he ate the rice, and he drank the milk. And he said, "Thank you so much." And then he went back into the woods, and he started meditating again. And what happened then is debated in Buddhist tradition, but he meditated all for a day and a night. And as the morning star came up, he had his great awakening experience, which we in Zen call Dai Kensho, great awakening. At the sight of the morning star, he had his Kensho experience. So, what happened exactly is not clear to Buddhist tradition. Although I have known many people who have had Daikensho and have had that experience myself. So it's a real experience, but what the Buddha did to get there is a little bit debated. The great Zen teacher Dogen, I think, had it exactly right. The great Buddhist Dogen said that the Buddha went into samadhi, he went into deep mushin, and there's levels of emptiness. There are times when you're sitting in empty mind where you're sort of hovering in that emptiness. And then there are times in that emptiness when you go into it so deeply, time disappears, and your sense awareness disappears almost completely except for your hearing. And sometimes even your hearing disappears. This is like a deepest form, you could say, of emptiness or nothingness. And in this state, all self-consciousness is gone. There's just awareness of, sometimes there's awareness of breath or just awareness of nothingness. There are intervals where there's no self-consciousness, there's no awareness of like a form, like a sensory impressions. This is the deepest form of emptiness. And it's quite likely the Buddha went into that very deep form of emptiness and then came out, sort of came back up, went to the bottom of the ocean and came back up, and experienced sense awareness. So he went from ordinary consciousness and ordinary sensory awareness into samadhi, into deep machine, and then back into the world of sensation. So he went from the deepest emptiness into the world of form, is how we would say it in Buddhism. And when he made that circuit, he had enlightenment. So actually, in Zen practice, we go through that again and again. We go through that circuit. You know, we enter samadhi, which is very blissful and beautiful, but not enlightenment. And then we enter deep mushin, and everything, we can enter so deeply, everything disappears. And then often the koans we're working with call our attention to something in our surroundings. The koans don't tell us what to pay attention to. They're like subliminal cues. So they give you a hint that operates on an unconscious level and directs your attention to something in the surroundings, in your surroundings, the world of form. So again and again in our Zen practice, we learn how to do the circuit, you could say, that the Buddha did. And then we go through that circuit over and over again. And every time we go through it, we wake up a little bit, you could say. Eventually, if you practice diligently for a certain amount of time, you will have Daikensho. So how long should you have to practice before you have Daikensho? Well, you know, that's hard to say. You know, there are people who have practiced Daikensho, really like Zen masters, who have had a Daikensho like 3 years into their training. The great Wei Neng had Daikensho just listening to the recitation of the Diamond Sutra. So Wei Neng had not even practiced Zazen, but had heard the Diamond Sutra and turned his attention. He must have gone through the circuit. He must have entered emptiness, returned to the world of form, and awakened. The great master Joshu had his first Daikensho, had his first Daikensho experience when he was 17 years old. And he became really probably the greatest Zen master of the Tang Dynasty. After he had his Daikensho, he said, some people would say, well, that was great. Now I'll write a book and I'll go on the talk show circuit and I'll tell everybody what a great guy I am. But Joshu just said, that was wonderful. I'd like to have more of that. How do I do that? And somebody said, you need to go study with Master Nansen. So Joshu studied with Master Nansen until Nansen died, and then Joshu practiced Zen until he himself died, according to the records, at about 115. You know, how long will it take you? You know, the stories of great Zen masters are filled with stories of people who had to practice for 20 years. 20 years. So if you're getting, if you've been practicing for, say, 6 years and 7 years and you're a little discouraged, please don't be too arrogant. You know, it takes however long it takes. The greatest Zen teacher probably in the last 500 years was a Chinese man whose name was Shuyun, empty cloud. He was born, according to reliable records, around the time of the American Civil War, and he died around 1958 from a beating delivered by Red Guards. Shuyun did not have his great... Shuyun, by the way, was his father didn't like Buddhism. And Shuyun had an early interest in Buddhism, and his father decided that the best thing he could do was to marry Shuyun off at 16. And he found a wealthy and beautiful wife for his son. And he figured that once his son and this woman began to live together, they would be good Confucian sons and daughters. And they would have lots of children and make pursue wealth and so on, and prestige. But Shuyun actually had got together with this girl, and he said, "You know, let's be married in name only, and let's practice zazen." This is true, and they agreed. And as soon as Shuyun's father died, the marriage was annulled, and Shuyun became a monk. And his daughter, his wife, became a nun, and they both became very famous meditation teachers. Shuyun was about 18 when he was, or 19, I guess, when he was ordained, and he practiced faithfully every day of his life. And he had his daikensho when he was in his late 50s. So it took him a long time to wake up. But, you know, having your daikensho after 2 years of practice is not necessarily a great accomplishment. You know, some things take a long time to ripen. But when they do, look out. So it's not a competitive sport, right? It's not a competition. There's not a stopwatch, you know. It's in the readiness of time. Things have their own way of unfolding in your life. You can only live your life. If you're interested in waking up, please pursue waking up. Don't let things get in your way, and don't compare yourself to others. Okay, that's very important. If Shuyun had compared himself to others, he would have quit. He would say, "Oh my God, everybody else is waking up. How come I can't wake up?" Shuyun could actually sit motionless for many days. Motionless for many days. Days. You know, if you ask people, how long have you meditated? And you've gone to a seven-day session, you could say 7 days. But when Shuyun went to a seven-day session, seriously, he would sit for 7 days and not move. And there are lots of witnesses to this. He was invited to come to Thailand by the king of Thailand and lead a meditation session. And he was surrounded by people, and he sat down and he didn't get up for 7 days. So it still took him 50 years to wake up, or 38 years to wake up. So, you know, it's worth, some things are worth waiting for. All of this is, so far we've been focused on the Buddha. Shakyamuni, we call him, or Siddhartha Gautama, and his practice of meditation. About 1,000 years into the development of Buddhism, there was like a revolution in the way people thought about meditation practice. See, I mean, in Buddhism, there are the original scriptures, the Pali Sutras. They were written down in a language close to the Buddha's own language. But the sutras don't stop with the Pali Sutras. For example, we recite the Heart Sutra. Zen Buddhists are very committed to the Diamond Sutra. That's our major sutra. Another important sutra for Zen Buddhists is the Lankavatara Sutra. Now, the Heart Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, and the Lankavatara Sutra were all composed more than 1,000 years after the Buddha had died. So how can they be sutras, which claim to represent the actual speech of the Buddha? Sutras actually began, "Thus have I heard out of the mouth of the Buddha these words. Thus have I heard." They all began that way. And these sutras were written 1,000 years after the Buddha, but they all say, "Thus have I heard." So what's going on? Well, Buddhism has a different attitude than, say, Christianity or Islam. In those religions, you're not really allowed to develop new books of the Bible or new books of the Quran. You can't say, "Hey, I have a new book for the Quran. I wanted to add it," right? That could get you in a lot of trouble, right? But in Buddhism, we say, "Oh, well, let's read it. Oh, this sounds pretty good. We'll add it." See? And that's because Buddhism is not a revelation. It's an ongoing project. It's not a finished revelation. It's an ongoing project. Everybody is contributing something important to the experience and understanding of enlightenment. And so it's an unending project. We recite the four great vows, Wei Neng's four great vows. We say one of the four great vows says, people who are in emotional distress, sentient beings who are in distress, are innumerable. In other words, there'll never be an end to suffering, but we will not stop until the last bit of suffering is done with, until we have eliminated the last bit of suffering. In other words, we'll never stop trying to eliminate suffering, try to assist beings who are in distress. One of the other lines in the Four Great Vows is, the knowledge of enlightenment is infinite, but we will never stop trying to learn it. See? And that's because Buddhism is not a fixed, it's not a finished revelation. It's an ongoing project. And that's why Buddhists are so comfortable saying, this sounds good, let's add it. So everybody in the Mahayana knows that the Diamond Sutra didn't come out of the Buddha's mouth. It was written by great meditation masters 1,000 years after the Buddha died. They were still practicing the circuit and having deeper insight into the nature of consciousness and awakening. And they taught that form is emptiness and emptiness is form, which is implicit in the Buddha's teaching, but something they really discovered that was truly new. So around 1,000 years after the Buddha died, there was like this revolution in Buddhism, because people said, the Buddha was enlightened, but enlightenment is not something you don't have and then it's something you have. It's not something you lack and you acquire. That's a misunderstanding of what happened to the Buddha. Enlightenment is consciousness itself. See, people were meditating 8 hours a day, going to sesshins, cultivating awakened mind. And they realized at some point, there's been a big mistake here. We thought enlightenment was something people lack and then that they get. But that's not true. They have it all along. It's the base of consciousness. All consciousness is enlightenment. And then it's like white light going through a prism and being refracted into colored light. Enlightened consciousness is fundamentally enlightened, and then it's refracted, into happiness and sadness, joy and suffering, likes and dislikes, all the different forms that consciousness can take. But when we sit on a cushion and we enter deep samadhi, and then we go into mushin, If we turn our attention to the nature of consciousness itself, we realize there's no moment of consciousness which is not enlightenment itself. So this was like a great transformation of Buddhism. This was the moment when Buddhism went from being just Buddhism to being what we call the Mahayana, the Great Way. It's called the Mahayana because if you think about the implications, they're pretty important. You know, it's possible to think about enlightenment as something only very special people have. So, you know, when we see the Dalai Lama, we think, oh my God, the Dalai Lama, he's got it and I don't. Now, the Dalai Lama goes out of his way to say that he is just an ordinary person. You know, I myself have never met the Dalai Lama in person, but I have many friends who have met him, and they say one of the remarkable things about him is that he's totally genuine and unpretentious. So, you know, when you meet the Dalai Lama, he doesn't look very holy. He doesn't look at you with significant glances. He doesn't look off into the distance with a mysterious gaze, right? He doesn't have a knowing little elfish smile when you ask him a question. You know, he's very ordinary. You know, he's like an ordinary, and he says, I'm an ordinary monk, you know. And people think, oh, the modesty of that man, you know. He's God on earth, but he says he's an ordinary, no, he's an ordinary monk. He means it. Because the teaching is that your consciousness is all human, all sentient beings, even non-humans, according to the teaching. All consciousness is fundamentally enlightenment. So the problem is we get confused. We get tangled up in our own mental projections. And then we fail to remember that all of these different forms, all these different colors are coming through the prism. And when we look at the light on the other side of the prism, it's pure white light. And that's at the base of our mind. So, you know, Buddhism went through this revolution. It was like everybody is fundamentally awake. Another sutra of great importance for Zen is the Lotus Sutra. And in the Lotus Sutra, there's a conversation between the Buddha and one of his followers. And this sutra was probably written at a time when foreign invaders had destroyed many Buddhist countries. People from the West had come into places like Afghanistan and Pakistan and destroyed the Buddhist cultures there. And you remember recently that some people blew up the remaining Buddhist statue in Bamiyan in Afghanistan. Well, this is a long process. This kind of violence has been going on for a long time. So in the Lotus Sutra, a monk says to the Buddha, oh my God, what can we do to protect our precious teachings? And, how will we stop this destruction from happening? You know, our precious teachings might be wiped off the face of the earth. And the Buddha in the sutra says, no need to worry, not to worry. You know, consciousness, he said, even if all of these sutras are wiped off the earth, consciousness itself is enlightenment. You know, don't worry. You know, even when it seems like the darkness is going to envelop everything, it can't. Because consciousness itself is fundamentally awake. Even though humans seem so fucked up, so totally violent and awful, fundamentally not so. See. So, you know, we get confused about this. You know, in our everyday lives, you know, in our everyday lives, we get up in the morning and we say, you know, we tend to inhabit the perspective of the, we say in Zen, the small self. And I do it too. I get up in the morning and I say, you know, hello, Kurt. Hello. What would you like for, what would make Kurt happy for breakfast? You know, and I go to the refrigerator and I look in yogurt. Not today. How about fresh fruit? Well, maybe, but you know, I had fresh fruit yesterday. You know? How about this? Oh, that might be just, oh, no. You know, so this is like an ordinary self, going through the day, pleasing ourselves, and trying to avoid suffering, right? You know, trying to have happiness and avoid suffering. And you know, pretty soon we create a world which is very divided into things we like, things we dislike, people we like, people we dislike. You know, I like to, and I do it too, right? I mean, I don't like to do some things, and I like to do other things. You know, I'm a Democrat. I'm a socialist. You know, I don't particularly like people who hate socialism. You know, it's definitely so. But you know, these mental habits create a big problem for us. Because our world doesn't get bigger and bigger, it gets more and more restrictive. And, you know, by saying, I like this and I don't like this, this is good and this is bad, yes, no, you know, we're gradually losing touch with that fundamental luminous consciousness at the base of our minds. So when we recite this morning, we recited the verses on trust in mind. And it says, gain and loss, right and wrong. Such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. So a lot of Zen practice is trying to get out of these mental habits of, what would you like for breakfast, Kurt? You know, and sometimes it even means becoming one with things we dislike, or things that we find repugnant, you know, things that we find repugnant. There are lots of stories in Indian Buddhist tradition of great meditation masters who had their daikensho when they did things like kiss the hand of a leper. And things like that. And it's not about mortifying yourself. It's about embracing what you fear or embracing what you find repugnant. You know, when we separate ourselves from the world around us, we create a smaller world. When we become one with the thing we have said no to, we return to the source. So in this koan, a monk asked Umon, what is Buddha? And, you know, the early Buddhist answer would be, the Buddha is a human, would be, who is Buddha? Who is Buddha? Interestingly, somebody actually asked the Buddha, what are you? You know, apparently the Buddha, Buddha was respected as a deeply enlightened person. And he was going through a village. The Buddha taught ordinary people. He had no possessions. He begged for his food all his life. He went into villages and taught the Dharma. He didn't hang around rich and powerful people. He didn't have a book deal or a movie deal. He would go into villages and he would talk and try to help people with their distress. Somebody came up to him who was helped, you know, and said, you know, I did what you said, and I feel so much better. I was, you know, in crushing depression, and now I feel so much better. Are you a god? You know, what are you? And the Buddha said, he said, are you a god? Are you a human being? The Buddha said, I am awake. See, what are you? I am awake. Monk asks Uma, what is Buddha? So the early Buddhist answer would be Siddhartha Gautama lived in northeast India. He was a member of the Shakya tribe, which traces its ancestry back to sugar cane, etc., etc. Monk asked, and he had enlightenment after meditating on his own under a tree and seeing the morning star come up. The Mahayana answer is a little different, right? It's not about the person of the Buddha. It's about the enlightened nature of consciousness. So a monk asked Uman, what is Buddha? And Uman said, Kanshiketsu. Now, what is Kanshiketsu? I haven't told you all this time. It's in Chinese, you know, toilet paper is a recent invention. You know, in most historical periods, paper was incredibly rare and hard to produce. So even today in Japan, in like Shinto shrines, paper is very important as a special ritual item, because it is so scarce. So the idea that you would wipe your ass with paper, you know, that's just like a very modern idea. So how did people wipe their asses? You might want to know. You know, in Chinese temples, there was a stick. It's not hygienic, I have to admit. But when you went into the outhouse, there would be a stick, so you could wipe yourself. Everybody used the same stick. So somebody says, what is Uman, what is Buddha? The Buddha doesn't say, you know, the light. He doesn't say, blah, 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 blah. This is a shit stick. You just came out of the outhouse. It was that shit stick. We have a lot of anxiety about our bodily functions. But, it is definitely not the Buddhist view that the body is unclean. It's definitely not the Buddhist view. That's not an enlightened view. You know, enlightenment is only possible for embodied beings. So to be born in a body is a great gift, great gift. This body is like is a sacred temple. Right? My body is sacred. Your body is sacred. The idea that it's unclean, you know, is a false view from the Buddhist standpoint. You know, so, what is Buddha? Shit. Now, it's saying, okay, everything is holy. Everything is clean. But it's also saying, look, we all fear shit. We do. When I go to the bathroom, if I'm at work and I have to go to a meeting and I go to the bathroom, you know, I have this says something about me, but I definitely, after I come out, I check my hands to make sure they're clean, and then I wash them very thoroughly. You know, if I went into a meeting and I looked down and I saw some excrement on my hands, that would be like the worst possible. I would prefer to die rather than have it happen to me. You know? I don't think I'm alone in that anxiety, right? So the koan is really saying, look, what do you fear? What do you dread? What do you look at with repugnance? Your challenge is to become one with that. Become one with that. And that's so much of our meditation practice is about that. You know, we draw a line. We say, on this side of the line, it's clean, and on this side of the line, it's unclean. On this side of the line, it's holy. On this side of the line, it's profane. On this side of the line, it's admirable. On this side of the line, it's It's disgusting. But and the, you know, really, the truth is, you can't wake up until you dissolve that line. The practice of Zen is, Dogen said it so beautifully, no one could do better. To practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with the 10,000 things. A monk asked Umong, "What is Buddha?" Umong replied, "Kan shiketsu," a shit stick. Mumon's comment, Umong was too poor. Remember that whenever Mumon runs somebody down, he's paying him a compliment. So Mumon's comment, Umong was too poor to prepare plain food, too busy to speak from notes. He hurriedly took up shit stick to support the Dharma. The decline of Buddhism was thus foreshadowed. See, in other words, this is great. The decline of Buddhism will decline when people are afraid of crossing that line. Buddhism will decline when people say this is holy and this is not holy. You know, becoming one with what you fear, with what you loathe, with what you greet with anxiety, sickness, old age, death, is our path. Mumon's verse, lightning flashing, sparks shooting, a moment's blinking, forever missed. You have to be here now, 100%.